This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. University of Notre Dame sociology professor Jorge Bustamante will discuss immigration during an event Wednesday at Western Michigan University. Coming up, I'll talk with Bustamante about the humanitarian, economic, and international implications of immigration policy. But first, numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show an increase in the suicide rate for teens and adolescents nationwide. The rate of girls dying by suicide doubled between 2007 and 2015. We're going to discuss this very difficult subject with Susan Davis. She is Mobile Crisis Response Manager for Family and Children's Services of Kalamazoo. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me here today.
When you see those numbers from the Centers for Disease Control about suicide for teens, as well as even some young people who are not yet teenagers, what do they say to you?
They say to me that we need to do a better job of talking about this subject, looking for the signs when it comes to our youth, and looking at what are the preventative measures with our youth and with adults too. But with our youth, this is where we have an opportunity to catch things early and change them.
Is there an indication, or maybe even when we talk about suicide, is there a decent theory about what could be causing these numbers to go up?
Some of the research that's out there right now is not necessarily what's causing them to go up, but what can be factors that contribute to youth thinking about suicide and taking their life by suicide. And that can be that early childhood trauma. So youth that are physically abused, sexually abused, emotionally abused, neglected. Youth that have an early diagnosed significant mental health illness, especially major depression. Youth that start to use substances at an early age. So those are some of the things that are some indicators and that can be then resulting in youth committing suicide. And the other thing to think about with our youth is their brains aren't fully developed. And so that part of the brain that helps with decision making and helps you understand long-term consequences isn't fully developed till you're in your 20s.
Is there an age at which we could say that trouble signs could start showing up? I mean, some of the statistics we have here are for children as young as 10. Mm-hmm. At what age might there be some sort of a red flag?
It can be even earlier. I mean, we have been called out on kids that are 6 years old who are talking about killing themselves. And so looking for those signs of withdrawing, those signs of sadness, the signs of not wanting to be involved in those activities, talking vaguely about not wanting to be around, people would be better off if I wasn't here. Sometimes we hear those things and we ignore them because they're difficult to hear. We don't want to ask the next question. What does that mean? And having age-appropriate open conversations about suicide. It's a scary word for a lot of people.
And when we talk age appropriate here, I would assume that these conversations are quite different with somebody 10 as opposed to somebody 15, 16, et cetera.
Yes. It's how you word it. It sounds bad to say normalizing that conversation, but we don't hesitate to talk to our youth about using drugs and alcohol. We don't hesitate to talk to them about stranger danger. And so we need to talk to them about when things get tough in our lives, how we manage that, and that there are ways to manage the toughest problems, and it doesn't mean that we have to end our life in order to do it.
So you mentioned the idea of someone being withdrawn, maybe sad, talking about maybe it'd be better if I'm not here. Are there some other things that a parent might look for, or anybody else who's around a child regularly?
Those are really the big ones. Sometimes it's just picking up on a behavior change. So you've noticed that there's been a change in your child. Ask about it. I mean, it could just be a change in their behavior. And one of the things that gets missed a lot of times in our youth when we talk about depression is one of the classic signs of youth depression is anger and irritability. And so that gets missed and gets kind of written off as a teenager. But it really can be a significant sign. So if there's any change in that behavior, it's asking, hey, what's going on? Has something happened? You know, how are you feeling? Tell me about what's going on.
Is there a good way to distinguish between sort of regular adolescent teenage angst? I think all of us who went through it can remember a time or two when we were perhaps not at our best behavior-wise, but yet a difference between that and something which is more problematic.
How long it lasts. So as adolescents, moods go up and down. Kids' moods go up and down, and that's normal. So if this is something that's lasting a more significant amount of time, and it seems more severe than what that normal moodiness might be, we all get our teenagers, our kids who go in and slam their bedroom doors, and usually they come back out after a while. So this youth may want to stay in their room all the time. Another concerning area can be, too, looking at how much time they're spending online. And, you know, what are they accessing online and what are they reading online? We are in the age of social media and bullying through social media. And so looking at our use, internet use, what are they using? You know, if there's concerns talking to a teacher at school, have they noticed the same differences? Are they not hanging out with their friends like they used to at school? So things that are lasting a little bit longer and are more severe than the typical, I didn't get my way, so now I'm mad.
The Family and Children's Services materials that I read online included watching out for maybe someone who goes from seeming to be very troubled to all of a sudden very calm. And this is something that I think people have heard over the years, that if someone has decided they are going to commit suicide, they sort of accept it, and now the trouble is going to soon be past them, so they have a calm about them. At the same time, if a teenager just continues to act out all the time, that can also be a troubling sign as well. So I guess I'm wondering, how do you know that someone has worked their way through whatever was bothering them that might have had them thinking horrible thoughts, including suicide?
Asking them, we need to know what the issue was that was bothering them, and asking them why they feel different about it, how they've solved it. Because again, with our adolescents, they can get over something very quickly. Maybe they had a fight with their boyfriend, fight with their girlfriend, fight with a friend, and then it's over. But it's also true that you need to look for that sudden change in behavior, because usually if there is a diagnosed mental health issue, like a major depressive disorder, that doesn't go away overnight. So that could be a sign. And then they talk about, and you don't see this as much in youth, giving away possessions, making sure your affairs are in order. Oftentimes with youth especially, they will leave some kind of written indication. They might post on social media saying goodbye to friends, to family. That's not always the case, but that can be something to look for. So again, it's just asking the question, wow, you seem really happy today. That's very different from how you were yesterday. And looking for the signs, those signs from the youth.
If a parent does suspect that their child is depressed and perhaps think that their child could be contemplating killing themselves, are there services available, places they can turn for help?
Yes. In Kalamazoo County, we have a variety of services. So it's always a recommendation to reach out to professional help to have an assessment done. And so in Kalamazoo County, we have a program called Mobile Crisis Response, which is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week crisis response program for youth in Kalamazoo County that can be accessed by a parent to have a face-to-face intervention done immediately or scheduled for the next day or two. We also work with our local emergency departments, our local school systems, our local pediatricians, and responding to their locations to do immediate assessments, as well as it can be a phone call to give some guidance and support. The 211 line at Griffin is a way to access some resources. The helpline through Griffin is a way to access some resources. So there really are a lot of varieties and sources in Kalamazoo County. Our local pediatricians have gotten a lot more education on psychotropic medications, on mental health issues. So we really are very lucky here in Kalamazoo County.
What would be the checklist, I guess, you might have a parent go through if they believe that there could be some troubling behavior?
We would ask them about the behaviors, what's going on. We would, one of the things that we always ask is what's in the home. So are there weapons in the home? And what medications are in the home? A lot of times what people don't realize is when oftentimes youth for suicide go to what's an easy means. And medication can be an easy means, especially females tend to gravitate towards medications a little bit more. But many of the over-counter medications that everybody thinks it's over-the-counter and it's safe can be very deadly. And so it's getting rid of all of the medications, locking them up and securing them. So have they noticed medications missing? You know, have they noticed knives missing? You know, what maybe are some things that weren't around that, you know, that could be a means to harm themselves? You know, are they not hanging out and seeing their friends like they used to? That's a big one. If they really start withdrawing and they just don't want to talk to anybody and they can be really moody and irritable.
How hard is it to get good research on this? David Lester, who's a professor at Stockton University in New Jersey, has spent a career for the most part studying this, and yet he said to Freakonomics when they did a podcast on this, he said he can't really tell you why people commit suicide. So when you're going through the research, how do you kind of sift out what really seems to be getting at this and yet what might still be leaving us in a fog?
It's talking to people who have thought about killing themselves. Those are the only people you can talk to. And it's asking them, what were they thinking? It's asking them about life experiences. Because one of the things that some of the research is showing, it's those early childhood life experiences when there are traumatic events that they experience, abuse, neglect, that can start to shape how things are managed in the future. And we have to remember that when those traumatic events are happening for them, their brains are still developing. So it literally can change how the brain functions and develops. And so that's where the early development of our youth is so critical and what they experience during that time. And then people are going to experience traumatic events. And then it's helping them learn how to manage and deal with those events. Life's not easy all the time. And we have to start teaching our kids young, how do you manage those things? How do you manage adversity?
Netflix this year debuted a show called 13 Reasons Why, which was about a teenager committing suicide and leaving behind the recordings which explained who it was that she said caused her to commit suicide. This prompted a lot of controversy. Some people said it glamorized it. You wrote about this for Family and Children's Services. What do you think the show did in terms of perhaps getting people to at least talk about this?
It did a great job getting people to talk about the subject of suicide, especially the subject of suicide in our youth. Kids were watching this. Kids were talking about it. Adults were talking about it with the youth. And so that was critical and important that we're okay talking about it. We're okay talking about the word suicide and the word killing yourself. So that was, it was a gateway to conversations. And it's a very complicated topic. It's a very complicated show in all of the areas that it looks at. And I think one of the most important things that we always need to send the message is that there is an option to solve whatever is going on. Suicide is not the only option. It's not the only answer. It's the final answer. And there are lots of options to solve our problems.
And is just having a conversation about the subject of suicide, especially when we're talking young people, difficult to just even get started because the subject is so horrific?
It is. I often find when I do presentations and talk to people about suicide in youth and how do they ask the question, and I say you have to use the word suicide, and they're horrified. They look at me with this look of terror on their face, like, you want me to use that word? I might give them the idea. And like, I guarantee you, you're not giving them the idea. Research shows that they're already thinking about it. And as soon as somebody brings it up to them, it's an instant relief because it's like, oh, I can talk about this. with this person. I don't have to hold the secret inside of me. Somebody has asked me what I'm thinking about. It's the tough thing. It's a very tough conversation to have. And there are ways to start the conversation that make it more normalizing.
Susan Davis, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Susan Davis is Mobile Crisis Response Manager for Family and Children's Services of Kalamazoo. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Jorge Bustamante is a researcher and human rights advocate for international migrants and refugees. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Notre Dame. He has served in various positions on the issue of immigration, including with the United Nations. Professor Bustamante will speak at noon on Wednesday in the South Ballroom at Western Michigan University's Bernhard Center. His address is called DACA Dreamers and the Undocumented, a Human Rights Perspective. It's sponsored by Western Michigan University's Lewis Walker Center for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations. Jorge Bustamante, thank you for being with us.
Sure.
Let's start with the basic idea of immigration. There's a lot of facets to it, but if we were just going to focus for the moment on the idea of a human rights perspective, what does that mean for immigration?
What it means is that it's a source of empowerment that countries have agreed to protect the integrity of immigrants as human beings, regardless of their migratory status. And that is something that has not been universally accepted in practice, particularly by countries that demand the cheap labor of these migrants. Coming to the present time, the phenomenon of immigration from Mexico and Central America to the United States historically has created peculiar situations, such as the case of these 800,000 of migrants that were brought to the United States by their parents when they were very young. And now, of course, they are adults after having received a public education in the United States. And that's in the period of President Obama, they were protected by what is called DACA. DACA is a permit to stay on a legal basis and to have work in the United States for these migrants that came, regardless of their will, came brought. They were brought by their parents to the United States without any documentation, and so they are technically undocumented. And that condition of vulnerability was improved by the decree of this measure by President Obama, which has been a very central part of the debate of immigration in the United States right now. President Trump has initially, in his electoral campaign, has established a threat to deport all documented immigrants from the United States. That means deporting several millions. In fact, the estimate is about 12 million of undocumented immigrants, which even Republicans have stated that that would be unfeasible.
So you mentioned in that answer cheap labor. If you are trying to separate out the issue of human rights from the economic questions which surround immigration, can those things be dealt with separately, or do they all eventually kind of come together in a way where you really can't address one without the other?
You're right. In fact, this is something that, of course, it's two sides of the same coin. The same coin is the phenomenon of undocumented immigration in the United States. That's a reality of several millions of people. The labor condition is actually the result of a power asymmetries between the migrants and those who employ them. And that asymmetry of power, of course, is reflected in conditions of abuse and conditions of violations of human rights. But that asymmetry of power also is related to the conditions make the migrants all around the world to be subjected to exploitation in the labor conditions, and that is something that produces the ambivalence in many countries, in particular in the United States, of wanting the cheap labor of the migrants on the one hand and rejecting them as members of American society. That ambivalence is part of the American history of immigration.
When you are looking at the human rights of migrants who come to the United States, do you consider the fact that they might have come here, as you said, for the ones who came under DACA? They came as children with their parents before they ever really knew any country to call home. Do they fall into a different category than someone who might have come here as an adult?
Yes, definitely, because DACA is the executive decision from the part of the President of the United States, namely President Obama, to allow these minors, these persons that were brought as minors with no documentation to the United States, and now they are in the labor force, to work in the United States and to be treated under conditions of legal stay in the United States. So that is something that, of course, make a tremendous difference between those that are without that condition, namely their parents. Their parents are that if they enter without documentation to the United States, as it was the case of more than 10 million, then they are subject to deportation. And that has been the case. And President Obama actually promised to deport them all.
You said before that immigration is not just a domestic issue. As much as it gets a lot of attention in the United States for the economic implications and other things, that it's a broader issue than that. What do you mean by it goes beyond being a domestic issue for the United States?
Well, because it's almost by definition an international phenomenon that, according to the United Nations Population Agency, involves 230 million of human beings crossing borders throughout the world, and that is something that produces a great variety of modalities in terms of the respect of the human rights of these human beings in the various countries where they are present.
Of course, people look here in the United States and we realize how difficult it is to get comprehensive immigration reform through the United States Congress. If you have to go a step beyond that now and reach agreements with other nations about how immigration is going to be enforced or what the rules are going to be, how difficult is it to get some sort of real agreement between nations on immigration?
It is extremely difficult. It's something that has taken place in a few number of countries, particularly between Mexico and Canada. They have agreed on the labor migration in a very rational way. That is not perfect by any means. It has there are bases for criticism, but nevertheless, it was a very rational approach that actually follows the recommendation of the United Nations that in the cases international labor migration, the most rational way to solve the conflicts associated with that is bilateral negotiations or multilateral negotiations. But that is as difficult as it has been in the history of labor throughout the world between to resolve this asymmetry of powers between the workers and the employers.
You have said that recent election results, mainly, I think in 2014, you said when the Republicans took control of the Senate, that was going to be bad news for migrants. Of course, President Trump ran on building a wall between the United States and Mexico and on increasing deportations. So I guess I'm wondering, people who voted for that, is that what they wanted, was to make it tougher on migrants? And if so, what does that mean for the future of the United States and its neighbors?
Well, particularly for the future of migrants themselves, it's a very dark scenario in the future, very ominous future, because there is no question that the hundreds of thousands of followers of President Trump, in terms of his ideas of building a wall and expelling the undocumented migrants, that is something that that of course produces a very ominous scenarios, not only in the United States but many other parts of the world. Look at Europe and the political scenarios in Europe are increasingly pushing for restrictions for immigration. That, of course, Germany, under Madame Merkel, has been an exception. But paradoxically, her victory in the last elections in Germany has produced a stronger reaction of anti-immigration in Germany, as you know. So the United States is not alone in producing these conditions of a dark future for migrants.
Should there still be, however, some enforcement, I guess, along the border? I mean, is it wrong to think that there should be some way of limiting the influx of immigrants, maybe not quite the way that President Trump has spelled it out? But is there a way that the U.S. can, to maybe use your words, humanely have some border enforcement and to also have some mechanism by trying to ensure that the people who come here, for the most part, are here legally?
Absolutely. That's perfectly possible. That has been done, as I mentioned, between Mexico and Canada. However, the difficulty is the strength of the power of the ideologies, of anti-immigrant ideologies that I alluded before. But the rational solution to the problems associated with immigration certainly is what has been recommended by the United Nations, bilateral negotiations. And these negotiations, of course, should accommodate, like in any labor negotiation, should accommodate the needs of the and interest of the two parties. And like in any labor dispute, a rational approach is to have positions that would actually enter into a context of willing to compromise. And that certainly would be the case of Mexico, that would have to accept restrictions of the border migration flows, and from the part of the United States offering conditions of respect of the human rights of the migrants.
Jorge Bustamante is a professor of sociology at the University of Notre Dame. He will speak at noon on Wednesday in the South Ballroom at Western Michigan University's Bernhard Center. Thank you very much for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Jorge Bustamante's address is sponsored by Western's Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations. It's called DACA Dreamers and the Undocumented, A Human Rights Perspective. You can find links with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.